Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. With just 3 weeks to polling day, we debate the big issues in the upcoming family referendum and we'll hear from both sides. Controversy continues over golden handshakes at RTE. The media minister says she's been reassured that Breda O'Keefe's €450,000 payment was within RTE's rules and doesn't need to be reassessed. Strong feelings in the County Louth town of Drogheda over plans to accommodate asylum seekers at a local hotel. We get the latest. And as WhatsApp lowers its age limits, we ask, do the tech titans care about the harmful content that our children see online? First tonight, the country goes to the polls in just 3 weeks' time to vote in the family and care referendums. The referendum on the family is seeking to amend the constitution and expand the definition of the family beyond just marriage. The amended text, if passed, would read like this. The state recognises the family, whether founded on marriage or on other durable relationships, as the natural primary and fundamental unit group of society. Well, to debate this, I'm joined by Fine Gael Senator Mary Siri Carney, Karen Kiernan from the One Family, both advocating for a yes vote, Independent Senator Michael McDougall and Sunday Times columnist Brenda Power wishing for a no vote. Let's get both sides. First to you, Karen McKiernan, because your group One Family was a group founded by single mothers. So let's start with why you believe this constitutional amendment is needed to recognise families outside of the nuclear or specifically marital founded family.
Yeah, it's a great amendment that we've been looking for 50 years. Our founders who founded Cherish back in 1972 are now women in their 80s. And it's so important to them that the family, the country now goes out and recognises their families by voting yes, yes on the 8th of March. I'm thinking of Mary Kerrigan from Clare. She's 83. She has said publicly, I really want my fellow citizens to go out and do this so that she will feel included because they had such a tough time. They kept their children under difficult circumstances. They founded a national movement and they've helped hundreds of thousands of people. So it's for them, but it's also for the 43% of children who are being born today to parents who aren't married to each other. It's for long-term cohabiting committed couples, and it's for the kinship carers. It's for people who step in, the grandparents, the aunties and uncles, who mind family members when the parents aren't able to. So it's bringing all of those people in, which we've been told is about 1 million people. So this is a really positive opportunity that has been long awaited and will really provide equality for children and families.
Okay, on this one, Brenda, the Constitution has a view on family right now, and it's one that's based on marriage. It's a very narrow definition, isn't it, really, given, you know, what we heard from Karen there, that, you know, 40% of children born are born outside of marriage. And should our Constitution now reflect that?
Well, of course, since the children referendum, the children, whether they're born within or without marriage, have absolutely the same rights. They're not treated any differently under the Constitution. My concern about this, Claire, is really the fact that the definition of durable relationships is non-existent. We don't know what will constitute a durable relationship after this referendum, if this referendum is passed. And so the sort of constitutional and statutory mayhem that that could cause is unquantifiable. We simply don't know what will constitute a durable relationship. We've been told that the measure of a durable relationship will be how other people treat you. Do they send you Christmas cards as a couple? Do they invite you to weddings and events and parties as a couple? And that's all well and good, but I mean, you just kind of just talked about
who said that on the,
I think it was
the
Judge Mary Baker. Judge Mary Baker said
all right. What Rodrigo Gorman, because we asked him yesterday in an interview about that, about what is a durable relationship. And he said, we've chosen that language to ensure that we can protect other types of families beyond marital families, and that there is other language within the text there talking about a primary fundamental group in society and a moral institution that will guide us in terms of what constitutes a family.
Again, and I know he used the term moral institution in the Dáil when the question of thruples came up and said, no, that wouldn't be a moral institution. Again, that's not going to be in the Constitution, but also the definition of moral institution. And the other concern I have, we talk about the inclusion of single-parent families. If this definition of a durable relationship is clearly based on an intimate, committed, romantic relationship, which it clearly is, if those are the definitions we're given, then what about the single parent who's not in a durable relationship?
OK, do you want to answer that one specifically, Karen? Because you're representing, you know, single parents.
Yes,
and what
so
Brenda
is
saying
really
that they don't fall within this durable relationship.
They absolutely do. And I can assure everybody we would not be spending time looking for this if they weren't included. And the reason I know they're included is because there is a political and policy intent that the government has clearly said repeatedly that they are included. That's the minister, that's the Taoiseach, they have said it. But also legal experts have given us advice and said, because it says on or on other durable relationships, that it is not connected in any way just to a horizontal or intimate relationship, that is specifically designed, and the Attorney General has said this, to allow for those vertical relationships, i.e. children and parents. That is the point of this amendment. So it's really important that voters know that single parent families, their children will absolutely be included.
For you, Michael, that's at the crux of your issue with it as well, about this, what is considered a durable relationship? You know, what about what Karen's had to say there, that it is, you know, not like linear, you know, you're going to have it between your mother and a child, and that there's many things that constitute durable relationships and families are formed on in this country now.
Well, Karen is correct that the minister said in the Seanad in front of myself and Mary Seary Carney that it was vertical as well as horizontal, and that he wanted it to apply to single parent families. She's correct in that. But the problem with that is what the minister says doesn't mean what the courts eventually find the Constitution to mean. And just to take an example, single-parent families, just take that example. Supposing there's, a mother and child, that's a very simple example, but take a slightly more complex one, a mother who has two children with one father, and he goes away and forms another relationship with somebody else, and she gets another partner by whom she has, say, two more children. Are the four children and the two parents a single family? Is the man who disappeared and formed another family out of that family? These are questions which just simply are not going to be answered by the government.
What difference can that make if that's something that has to be decided by the courts?
Well, you see, that's the very point. I mean, if we had, we put before minister an amendment saying, please leave the definition to the Oireachtas. And he said, no, absolutely not. That would create two-tier families. I'm not going to do it. But the consequence is that every case, every decision of the courts arises in the course of a case. And Mary is a barrister, and Brenda's a barrister, and I'm a barrister. You're the only non-barrister.
I'm not a barrister.
But let's be clear about this. Courts decide disputes. So they don't decide general policies. They decide if two people come together. So the issue that I'm saying is crucial to this is the example I gave where the man went off and had two children by somebody else and left two children behind him. What is the family? Is he part of that family anymore? Did that family cease to exist the day he walked out the door? These are the issues which the courts will have to decide. And at the moment, we have a cohabitation law. And for instance, the Oireachtas has said, just let me finish on this, Claire. The Oireachtas has said, you're not going to get any benefits unless you've cohabited for 5 years or unless you've cohabited for 2 years and you have a child. That is going to be swept away.
Okay, so what you're saying is that's clear cut, and there are an act from 2010 that's in law that around cohabitation. And that's one of the criticisms of this, Mary Siri Carney, is the kind of vagueness about what encompasses a durable relationship and how that's going to play out in real life scenarios if you're putting it on the same footing as, say, a family founded on marriage.
Well, first of all, the Constitution sets out a special status of families and sets out that our society is founded on the family. The family, as a result, have particular rights. Those are rights of privacy, rights of decision making, that are especial to those to the fact their status as a family. The difficulty with that is, as you and I went about our days today and we met people dropping a child to midterm break camp, doing all of those things, queuing in the shopping centre, we met people who believe they are in a family, and we would look at them and recognise them as being in a family. They are our own friends, our own family members. They are single parent families, they are cohabiting couples with children. These are all families. The problem is that if they need to assert their privacy, assert their right to make a choice around their child in schooling, in whatever direction, in all of those things, if they need to make that decision, if they aren't a married family, they won't get that option, because the state in a court will argue that they are not a constitutional family, and so they don't have that status and they don't have that rights. And this referendum is all about justice and it being fair to those families that are living around us all of the time and need that status.
To what Brenda said there, that, you know, under the children's referendum, that there are rights afforded between, you know, a child, the rights of the child are enshrined now in the Constitution, and also around cohabitation laws, that they already exist and they're pretty clear cut in terms of what defining what a cohabiting couple, or, you know, defining that in law, that they offer protections in themselves. What would you say to that?
And there are other protections in the Constitution, but they don't include the definition of a family being representative of the society that we live in, the people that are all around us, the people that are our friends and our own family members. So they are not a constitutional family. Unless they're married to each other, the state doesn't recognise them as a family. And if you're sitting in the court listening to the state argue that your family is not a family, that's a fairly lonely and frightening situation, that you think the constitution of your country doesn't recognise you as a family. That's a very stark, and that injustice and non-reflection of society needs to be addressed, and it will be done by voting yes on the 8th of March.
An equality issue here, Brenda would say, for people who are advocating for a yes vote on this, that over the years that there has been that stigma, that sense that, you know, if you don't fall into that family founded on marriage, that you're somehow lesser, that this is putting all of that to rights now.
Well, I mean, I know Michael doesn't agree with me on this, but I would have thought that it would have been sufficient to have taken out the line on which the family is founded after marriage in Article, I think it's 4313. And that would have then left the natural and ordinary meaning of the word family to be understood in the Constitution without any need to go any further and put in this really, you know, uncertain term of durable relationship.
So you take out marriage?
I would certainly support that. No, not take out marriage. What it says at the moment is that the state pledges to support the institution of marriage, subclause on which the family is founded. Mm-hmm. And I would have said that simply taking that line out, I would certainly have supported that, because that would then leave the non-marital family to be also included in the definition of family. My problem is with the durable relationships and the absolute nonsense that is a mayhem.
How do you think that will play out, you know, in a negative fashion, like in a very practical way? You've concerns around succession rights there, mm-hmm. About tax law.
Yeah.
Give us a sort of scenario you're talking about.
Well, okay, let me give you one maybe long shot scenario. But at the moment, we know that marriage revokes a will. If you've got a will, if you've made your will and then you marry without rewriting the will in contemplation of the marriage, your will is revoked from when you marry. If we are enshrining in the Constitution a durable relationship analogous to marriage, then the question will arise as to whether or not that has the same effect on succession law as marriage does. I mean, the court may well decide it doesn't, but it may well decide it does. We just don't know.
OK, and what will that mean?
Well, it would mean that you'd have to determine maybe when the durable relationship began, what the nature of the durable relationship was, but did it mean that in the circumstances where somebody engaged in a durable relationship without marriage, was their will invalid from whenever that relationship became established?
Okay, do you see that as a problem, Karen?
No, we don't, because we know that for real people out there, they are voting with their feet. Over 40% of children are being born to parents who aren't married to each other. Now, those parents may marry, they may never marry, maybe they can't, maybe it's a single parent on their own. But we have to respect and include those children. We also have to include all the other families. So there's families in and out to our organisation every day, and I listen to them. And this isn't their number one problem. They have cost of living crisis, they have homelessness, but it really matters. And if we vote no, or if we stay at home and don't vote, this is a rejection. This isn't status quo. This is an active rejection of these different kinds of families, the children who live in them. And look, we did so well in 2015. We included same-sex couples. It was a happy thing. This is another positive, happy thing for equality. And this is just our constitution reflecting the reality of modern life in Ireland. And we should welcome it.
Okay. Michael, on that, hugely symbolic, according to Karen, as well as from a practical point of view, reducing stigma and making things easier for single parent families here. Essentially, do you think that by referring to durable relationships as well as families founded on marriage, do you believe it dilutes the institution of marriage? Is that your concern here?
I mean, first of all, I posed an example of the person who left a single parent marriage, a single parent on her own, and somebody moved in with her and had two more children. Karen doesn't answer that question, and she says that'll be for the courts to decide on someday. But are there two families there? Does one family cease to exist when the man walks out? That's a good question. But a very interesting thing happened in the Dáil yesterday. Michael McNamara, TD, asked the Taoiseach whether there would be any particular special protections for marriage. And this is what he said in reply. If the referendums are passed and the constitution is so amended, it will still be possible for future governments and the Oireachtas to discriminate in favour of people who are married. That will not change. It will obviously be up to the Oireachtas and the government at the time to decide exactly on what basis they wish to favour or discriminate in favour of people who are married. Now, that's the argument he made. But when Mary Siri Carney and myself were in the Shannon, Minister O'Gorman said, no, he wanted all families to be the same, no differentiation between them, and the fact that you were married or unmarried was not to be relevant in the future. Now, I'll give you an example which I think is really relevant. The O'Mara case that we had recently, which was on social welfare entitlements and the widower's pension being paid to a man mm-hmm. whose partner didn't want to marry for 18 years. Apply that logic to taxation. Two couples living side by side in two houses with the same amount of children. One of them has all the benefits that go under the present tax system to married couples. The other says, in the same way as Mr. O'Mara did, excuse me, I have the same bills to pay. I have the same household expenses. Right. Why am I being taxed much more heavily than the people who got married? And what will happen then is, on an O'Mara basis, the Supreme Court will say to the Attorney General, you defend treating one household radically differently from another in tax. And the answer in the end will be that the state will be confronted with equality claims which leave the tax laws very seriously affected.
Right. Mary Siri Carney, do you want to come in on that and what Michael appears to be saying, sort of mixed messages from the minister regarding the impact this will have or otherwise on families founded on marriage?
Well, what we have, if we look at the O'Mara case, there was a man who took 3 years to eventually get what he should have gotten all along in the support of him and his children. He got it on the basis of equality. He got it on the basis of the status of his children and their right to be treated equally before the law. What he couldn't get it on was the fact of family, because his family was not recognised as a constitutional family. And that needs to be addressed. The O'Mara decision has led to a number of things that are going to have to be looked at from a policy perspective. But the fact comes back to it. They were a family. We all look at that and find them a family. Okay. But the Constitution doesn't recognise them as a family. And the Constitution needs to change to recognise the reality of people's lived experience.
So it goes beyond symbolism. And clearly, the implications that we're talking about here, you'd accept that there are going to be implications when it comes to tax treatment, when it comes to pensions. Succession and pensions and all of that. But that is something that you are welcoming.
It is something that is a matter of policy of government and how what that looks like and what would be the parameters of that. We limit the rights and liabilities in law all of the time, and we do that for the common good. But the fact of the matter is that there may be implications here. Of course there may be. I don't believe that the cost or the policy decision should be a bar to the fact that families, as we know them in our country, need to be recognised by our constitution.
The difficulty is
an insult to the people who live in those families.
The difficulty with that, Claire, is this, that if you can only be told that you're in a durable relationship by a court, how do you fill out your tax return at the end of any given year? Do you tell your tax inspector that your relationship is durable and you're claiming X and Y? And this means, in effect, that the courts will decide on a kind of a blank check basis issues of fundamental policy, for instance, in relation to wills being revoked, Succession Act rights, immigration rights, family reunification rights. The courts will be deciding that, and the Oireachtas will be staring at decisions coming down from the courts, which can only be amended by referendum.
Clearly, I need to just come in there, because the fact is that people will be going before the courts on particular issues, and they will need to argue that they are a family in order to get those powers of decision making or those rights or those whatever. It is only in that context that a durable relationship really comes into them proving we are a family, I am a family.
This, when you're before the courts.
When you're before
at that
the courts.
Point.
It is in at that
so what
point.
What about filling out tax forms and all those other things?
Well,
that, you know, that people will say, well, look, within the Constitution, I'm in, you know, a durable relationship here.
But
therefore,
it will be in accordance with whatever the requirement is to fill in forms. A lot of people don't fill in forms.
How durable is your relationship on a tax form?
Most people are BRSI and PAYE workers. They don't go filling in forms unless they're calling medical and making claims like that from the state on the money that they're due and they should be doing. But in that context, forms can be very clear on that. The provisions of government in ensuring that there are those rebates to people can be very clear on that. But durable relationships will only come up in the context of someone who's standing before the court saying, I am a family and I deserve to have these rights.
I know that there was great hilarity when the subject of truffles was mentioned in the Dáil, but the reality is that is not something that we can rule out either as a possibility, not necessarily truffles, but say you have a same-sex couple with a relationship with the surrogate mother of their child, and she's clearly got a blood relationship with that child, and that's a three-way relationship. If one of those parties dies following the O'Mara judgment, does that mean that the other two are entitled to claim for widowers, a widow's allowance? I'd say the problem
maybe
would.
Is that a problem? Is what I'm asking with all of this. Maybe this is the new reality.
Maybe,
not
maybe
that there are troubles living next door to everyone, but you know, defining what a new relationship or a durable relationship is in the Ireland of today.
All of these cases, you see, will have to go to the court and probably to the Supreme Court, because each case will be different. And the Supreme Court has already looked at the question of durable relationships and said a durable relationship doesn't necessarily have to be a long relationship. They couldn't put a time frame on it. So people can meet and fall in love and form commitments within a matter of weeks. Those could be durable relationships.
All right. Okay, I wonder, Karen, you're shaking your head there. Yeah. And I just want to give word to
this
you on
that. This is about real people. This is about children and parents and couples who we all know and love, who do the work day in, day out of caring and worrying about people. We know what families look like. This is mostly symbolic. So if you end up having to go to...
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The Supreme Court and the Constitution, you're in a very vulnerable situation, as John O'Mara was, and we have to thank him for taking that case. This is for all the people up and down the country, the million people who are going to be brought in symbolically and welcomed into the Constitution, and that's why we need to go out and vote yes.
See, I don't think anybody disagrees with Karen, but the point is that the way this is being handled, the way it is being construed, is going to cause mayhem.
All right. OK, well, look, there we have to leave it for now. Differing views on that and indeed on the other referendum, both of which will take place on March 8th. My thanks to Karen Kiernan. The others are going to stay on with me because coming up next, exit payments at RTE. Do stay with us. Welcome back. Media Minister Catherine Martin says she's been given reassurances by RTE's Director General that the €450,000 exit package to its former chief financial officer was within RTE's rules and did not need to be reassessed. The payment to Breed O'Keefe sparked heated commentary again today, including calls for at least some of the money to be handed back. Fine Gael Senator Mary Ciri Kearney, Senator Michael McDougall and Sunday Times columnist Brenda Power are still here with me. I want to come to you first, Mary Ciri Kearney, on this. We did hear from the Minister that she has been given assurances by the Director General of RTE, Kevin Backhurst, that it was compliant, that this exit deal of €450,000, that indeed it stuck to the rules and it was compliant with the terms of the 2017 voluntary exit scheme. Are you reassured by that? Do you think others in the political arena are?
I think you would need to see the actual detail of how that scheme is made up. You know, I've seen in negotiated packages for people over the years, there's a very clear matrix of how you arrive at a final balance. So I would like to see that. I would like to see that published of what are we working from and that arrived at such a place that the net payment was 450,000 and that everything else was going to be picked up by RTE and ultimately the taxpayer. So I think that needs to be published. And also then there are obviously that we need a transparency about the other packages that compare to a 2017 deal. So what is this, the 2017 deal?
And what's it look like for the majority of employees?
Well, this is the appalling thing. You know, there were people who scrimped and saved and were obliged to bring their own biscuits when they were doing broadcasts outside and around the country and all sorts of things. Meanwhile, there is a matrix of a deal that can leave somebody to have 450,000 and walk away with the organisation paying the tax on it. I think there are still questions to be answered.
So you'd like to see more detail and more transparency.
Just being told that someone is satisfied is not enough for me. No.
Yeah, and that's what we are hearing, this request for more transparency. Like on this, Brenda, do you think that audit should look further back than 2017 on exit deals and the amount of money that's been paid out to departing employees?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to believe that this is a discrete issue or that this, you know, was contained in time in any way. We don't know whether, you know, Dee Forbes inherited this particular corporate culture and whether it pre-existed her. So I would say, of course, there would have to be, and I agree with Mary, we need to know the details upon which Catherine Martin says she's satisfied that this deal met with all the requirements. Because I remember the time that this was last discussed, there was some explanation given to the effect that it was Breed O'Keefe herself who had drafted some kind of a business plan whereby she would be replaced by, I think, a junior colleague. And so her job technically would be axed, would be made redundant. But that didn't actually happen.
And that didn't work out.
A new outside
which I suppose individual questions the whole idea of redundancy and making a position redundant. If just there's a chief financial officer in place now at RTE,
exactly so the same job.
And big organisations require that.
Absolutely.
Michael, on this, like, what are the legal implications around like these exit packages? Because there may be moral questions, which has been brought up about like Breed O'Keefe, should she pay some of it back? And, you know, and I know the questions around asked around that from the opposition. But is there anything legally problematic with it?
I think there is. I think from a tax point of view and the taxation, if it's not a genuine redundancy situation, an employer that hands the bones of $500,000 to somebody who's going to another full-time job in another enterprise has tax liabilities in respect of it. So I can't imagine that a multi, $100 million, $200 million company such as RTE can survive without a chief finance officer. So therefore, the position wasn't being made redundant. Somebody else was going to be made, as did happen, the chief finance officer of RTE. And in those circumstances, you know, if you're somebody down the pay grades and the pecking order in RTE, and you're now going to be told that because of the crisis that you have to lose your job, if you see somebody disappearing out the back door with 450,000 in his or her pocket, you're going to say this is outrageous. And I think, you know, we're talking about transparency. I think people see through this a mile away.
Let's also ask, because people have raised questions about a recent departure, and that's of resigning employee Rory Coveney, and how he could legitimately get a payoff here. Like in the private sector, when somebody quits their job, they generally don't leave with money, but we know that an exit deal was also in place there. Yeah. We don't have details around that yet.
Well, there were weasel words there, I'm afraid. They said that he was not covered by this scheme, that he received nothing under this scheme on his exit. But I have no doubt that he received compensation as part of his exit from the organisation. So, again, we need transparency. And the PAC is entitled on behalf of...
And is there flexibility around that? Can an employer do that, decide to, that somebody somebody is leaving and that they can come to a financial arrangement around that?
Absolutely. I mean, in the private sector, you know, people are told it's time for you to go and here's a gratuity going. That's normal. But the difference here is this is state money. This is money which is got from the taxpayer or the licence fee payer. And what's happening here is that it's being allocated to individuals under the guise of cost cutting and redundancy when it isn't either.
And it's also important to say, I think, that yesterday Kevin Backhurst said, you know, when he was asked about the question of accountability, that, oh, there has been accountability and, you know, people have paid the price and people have been exited out of the organisation. But we need to know if those people were exited with golden handshakes, because that wouldn't sound much of a sanction to me if that was the case.
And I think that is a very crucial point. You know, he can't come in and argue that there's new culture and give us all assurances of that until we actually have the transparency of knowing what arrangements were arrived at and what applications are being put to those arrangements. Is he making agreements since whatever about that went on before him coming into the leadership of the role? But what agreements is he making? So I think it's in his interests and all of our interests that we see exactly the transparency of every deal and every exit.
Right.
And then we're able to make that comparison of the ordinary worker in RTE and what sort of a raw deal they're getting.
Briefly, I just want to get onto the issue of compellability here. We have the Oireachtas Media Committee and PAC looking for, I suppose, the key players in the RTE scandal to come before them. I mean, are they likely to face challenges over trying to force these people to attend when there are sick notes, when there are other issues and other excuses for not appearing before the Oireachtas Committee, Michael?
I think there will be difficulties. I mean, if people have genuine medical issues, and I'm not discounting that possibility. I mean, people are naturally cynical about it. And I saw somebody on social media doing a CloudFundMe appeal to send one of them off to Lourdes for a cure. I mean, people are cynical, but there could be major psychological or stress implications involved. And for a Oireachtas committee to effectively say we're first of all asking the House of the Oireachtas to give us these compellability powers, and secondly, if somebody disobeys us, we want to be in a position to send them to jail for disobedience, That's very, very difficult for politicians to do.
Yeah, and difficult ground as well when someone is not attending for reasons of illness. We'll leave that there for now. We want to briefly move on to a story coming from County Louth today in the town of Drogheda, where they're calling for a meeting with the Integration Minister to discuss plans to house up to 500 international protection applicants in the local D Hotel. Well, the Deputy Mayor of Drogheda, Kevin Callan, outlined their concerns to me.
Well, Claire, I called the meeting tonight because what happened yesterday was that Drogheda got a very shocking piece of news that we were losing a massive piece of our tourism infrastructure, which is going to impact about 5.4 million euros on our local economy per year. So I called the councillors together collectively, and tonight we agreed a joint statement, which was across all parties and none, to effectively demand the minister to meet with us to get into discussions about how this can be fixed.
All right. And what did you decide?
Well, the decision is that there are a number of issues which form part of this. Number one, how this decision was made without any consultation with the local community or the public representatives or Louth County Council. How a decision like this could be made where 10 years of work in tourism development has now been just thrown in the bin. We're looking at a number of options. One is possibly the seeking of an injunction around the fact that the hotel has changed use. But we would rather if the minister would sit down with us and discuss options for the financial situation of the town going forward and how he intends to mitigate the colossal damage and the risk to jobs and small to medium-sized businesses.
And that was Councillor Kevin Callan outlining the fears and worries of people in Drogheda around the D Hotel being used to accommodate people. Now, we know from the hotel that they're going to keep on the function rooms, the bar, the restaurant, that will all still be open to the public. But there's still deep financial concerns about the impact it will have on the town of Drogheda. Mary Siri Carney, when it comes to this, we're hearing yet again, where was the consultation? Why weren't people spoken to in the town about this? Why wasn't there a plan in place to get everybody on board with any such move?
And I am surprised, to be perfectly honest, that there wasn't advance notification to the councillors, to the public representatives. I know from my own home constituency of Dublin South Central, where decisions have been made, we have been given briefing in advance, namely not a huge amount.
No, it's happening advance. 3 weeks. Yeah. It is happening 3 weeks from now.
Yes, but apart from the fact that, yes, we have international obligations and we have a requirement of accommodation, and we want to do that also as a people, but there does need to be a calculation and a space here for a calculation of the economic impact. Because, yes, we'll have function rooms, so that means we'll have weddings and we'll have Holy Communions and we'll have all of those. And my concerns in the past when I have said in meetings ourselves of saying, why aren't we having economic impact assessments? That, you know, you have the florist that supplies the flowers for those weddings. You have all of that footfall. But here you have a town that has already seen job losses today with the announcement over the last few days of Marks and Spencers. So certainly there needs to be that level of an economic impact.
You're not, you can understand the ire of some in the community.
Absolutely.
Around this move.
But these are very real people with very real jobs that need to be safeguarded and an assurance. Yeah. And I don't think that it should be beyond the realms of possibility for all sorts of economic packages to be mm-hmm. put in to support the business community, as has been evidenced by the government at fairly various different stages over
all
the
right.
last number of years.
Brenda, briefly to get you on this, I mean, what we hear is there is an accommodation crisis. You have asylum seekers, intense homeless. So what is the government to do when you have a hotel saying, look, we have rooms that can accommodate 500 people?
Although I saw some locals from Drogheda today saying there are other vacant buildings in the town that could equally have been repurposed. And that, again, as Mary said, that the hit to the local economy, especially given the closure of Marks and Spencer, is really difficult to expect people to take without protest. And you see, the difficulty arising out of that is that these objections tend to be painted as the sort of the machinations of the far right, and these people unfairly and you know unjustly tarred as being anti-immigrant and racist, which they're not. They're concerned for their own communities and entitled to.
Briefly on this instance, I don't think that's being characterised
yeah.
at all.
So far,
the impact.
No.
And it is important that we remember that. Nobody is characterising this as anything other than deep concern. The councillor there used very tempered language and was very sensible and responsible. And that's the sort of engagement that we really genuinely need to get in. Because
you're a senator within a government party, Mary, as well on this, and this is what the government have come under a lot of criticism around, Michael. On this one, are there legal implications around using hotels in this manner now? I know there are, people would argue that there are planning implications. It's going to have a huge economic impact and that, towns need hotels.
There are planning implications and the planning laws aren't the only ones involved. And consultation can only go so far. The root cause of this is that Roderick O'Gorman has said that we are going to get 20,000 as the new normal of asylum or international protection applicants every year from now on. And that has to be tackled by the government centrally, and not merely at a national level, but at a European level. It's unsustainable, and the country cannot manage it. And Mary Siri Carney correctly says that we have at the moment got international obligations. But it's a time that we revisited those international obligations because we can't sustain this. And places like Killarney, Drogheda, Castlebar, you can't simply keep doing this.
But people will also point, Michael, to vacant properties that are there that are not necessarily hotels that could be used and bought up by the state and used in this instance. But we will have to leave that there for now. My thanks to Councillor Callan, who joined us on that, and to Michael. Mary and Brenda are staying on with me because coming up next is WhatsApp lowering its age limits. Is that putting children in harm's way? Do stay with us. Welcome back. Fine Gael Senator Mary Siri Carney and Sunday Times and Irish Daily Mail columnist Brenda Power are still with me. And we're also joined now by psychotherapist Richard Hogan, because we want to talk about WhatsApp and lowering the age limit for people to use the social media platform. And I suppose other concerns about, harmful content being shown to people at a younger age all the time, Richard. On this, we had WhatsApp reducing, as say, the minimum age from 16 to 13. Now, when I saw this, I said, well, what difference would that make? I mean, my 7-year-old grabs the phone off me and sends a little, tries to send a message to a friend using emojis or whatever. There are 7-year-olds, there are 6-year-olds using WhatsApp right now. I have never seen any sort of verification, or I had no knowledge that you had to be 16 to date to use it.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, when I looking at this morning, I was like, how much more evidence do we need to get from these companies, from these big tech firms, to show us that they don't really have our interest of our children at heart? They're not interested in having less traffic, Claire. They're interested in having more traffic. That's the key thing here. And so they keep telling us. And why aren't we listening to them? They're not interested in protecting our children from going on their platform. Meta got caught for 1.1 million children on Instagram. Right? Instagram is more harmful, I think, than say WhatsApp. And then Snapchat again is even more problematic again. And so we know that they want more traffic. We know that it's not that they want less. And then we also know the material that's on these platforms is particularly problematic for children.
But what do you do around the issue of age verification? Because we had the education minister, Norma Foley, who gathered a summit of social media companies, and she wanted a commitment to support age verification. But she said afterwards, that's not forthcoming at present. That's not what I'm hearing from the social media companies.
Claire, it just drives me mad that a commitment of support. Do we ask Benson and Hedges for a commitment of support? Do we ask the Vintners or Guinness for some support here? We bring in legislation to protect our children. Why are we so weak? It's so confusing to me. For 7 years, I've been going on about pornography and children consuming hardcore, damaging material. I'm like, well, why isn't there any regulation here to protect our children? And obviously, you have to come to the logical conclusion. It's a simple one. It's money. Someone somewhere is stopping this from happening. Yeah. Right.
We do have, and I want to ask you about this, Mary, because we have a new online safety commissioner in place who, and there's legislation coming forward. I mean, are we going to see a change to what we've had to date, which has been nothing in the way of sort of moderating social media companies and having any teeth to tell them what they can and cannot do?
Well, I think we do have the Online Safety Commissioner. She's actually coming into the Joint Directors Committee on Children next week, because we're in the middle of a conversation on this, this very fact of harm done to children and what we can do about it. So it would be good to hear from her and to explore what exactly she can do. She does have powers to have material taken down. But at the heart of this, there is a difficulty in that social media, full stop, has a business model that is selling the attention of us. Our attention is being sold to the highest bidder. And reducing the age in WhatsApp actually, to me, is a very cynical ploy on their part to get children inducted into the use, addicted, because then that addiction is what's being marketed. And it is. We need a cognitive security plan around children. We need the support of that. I think there should be health and mental health warnings that are obliged to go out on social media, actually. I think I would go down the Benson and Edges route, and I would completely and utterly support that. Yeah. I've had a long campaign of no smartphones if you're under 13.
And listen, they shouldn't have. They all sound like really worthwhile initiatives, but we've seen none of it to date, Brenda. Like, do you think there's an onus on the state to do more, or do you actually also think that, you know, it's up to parents to try and control what their kids do online? Is it a mix of both?
I think the parents have to take a certain amount of responsibility. I mean, we saw those statistics recently which said that I think it's 1 in 4 6-year-olds has a smartphone. I mean, parents need to wake up to what they're handing their child if they're giving them a smartphone. You're giving them access to the most hardcore porn that you probably can't even imagine. And this is bound to have an effect on developing psyches. I mean, we saw that case, the Brianna J case in England. Those young people had been consuming really hardcore porn from the age of about 12. The same in the Anna Creagel case. One of the young lads in that case, a boy A, had 12,000 hardcore porn images on his phone. So, I mean, there's only so much really when we know that there is no such thing as age verification. We all know that. I mean, they say, are you over 18? Click yes.
Well, look, on a very practical note on the age verification, and look, you met with politicians because this issue is really important to you, Richard. You know, what can you practically do? Like, what can you do around age verification? I mean, will there be that sort of face ID or, you know, because then there are data protection issues. Yeah. What are you going to do about it on a practical level?
Absolutely. We're in the age of AI. We hear about all these advances in AI. It's very simple with AI to actually do facial recognition. Or very simply, Claire, and I'm not a tech expert, but surely if you could put your email in at least, that would stop a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old from getting onto it. Maybe, you know, an identification would stop a 14-year-old putting their passport in or their driver's license or whatever. They'd get stopped there. But again, there's nothing in place. And these tech companies must be laughing when they're going to the government. I'd say I can see them drinking their avocado smoothies before they go in, having a good laugh about meeting the government, because this is just a box-ticking exercise. These fools won't do anything here. We're too powerful. We're dwarfing states. No,
we have... talking to politicians, do you think there's anything coming from Europe in that regard? Because that's what we seem to be hearing from the Online Safety Commissioner.
We will have the AI Act coming through. It was actually voted on a committee this week from the European Union. That will have an obligation of transparency. Mm. Let's see how that works out, and it actually needs to be voted and completed through until it is a proper regulation in the same way as GDPR. But under privacy law, you know, well, a lot of this is operating on the data that is gathered from people, and then that is profiling us to be marketed and our attention sold. You know, there are means. We just need to look at enforcement. We have the two new commissioners in the Data Commission this week appointed. So we need an upscaling there of enforcement of our data and our privacy rights.
And did you receive assurances on that one, Richard, meeting with the politicians?
Well, more talks are needed. I mean, that's okay. The problem.
All right, that is all we have time for. My thanks to Richard, to Brenda and to Mary and all our panellists tonight. From all the late team here, good night and do take care.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.